Thank you. Thank you, Daniel, for asking me, and thank you, everybody, for actually showing up. Is there anybody here from Fredericton? No? Is there? Who was it who laughed when Daniel said it was snowing? Because I'm going to get you with a laser pointer. Let me introduce some of my co-authors on this talk, first of all. These guys are all in my research group doing magnetic resonance imaging. Yongche is just finishing writing up now. Olusegun Adegbite, he's a PhD student working on cardiovascular flows. Alex Adair is doing his MSc at the moment. Mark Sankey visited us from the University of Cambridge, so he was a visiting graduate student, and I'm going to show some of all of their data as if I'd had something to do with it, but in fact, it's all theirs, obviously. And before I get on to talking about the data, I'll show you where I've come from in case nobody knows where Fredericton is. That's where we are, right down there. You're over here somewhere. And there are some pretty pictures of Fredericton. Actually, at the minute, in the fall, it looks like this. This is the university campus across the beautiful St. John River. When I say at the minute, of course, at the minute, it looks like this. And that may stop me getting home or not. So if it does stop me getting home, I'll be back to give next week's talk as well, you lucky, lucky people. The Department of Physics at UNB, we've got three research areas. In 1960 or so, Gerhard Hertzberg came by and said, concentrate on what you're good at. He did a review of the department and said, you should stick to the things you know. And these three research areas have grown out of the research interests at the department at the time. We're a much smaller department than U of T. There are 9 faculty members, 4 teaching staff. We have graduating classes in the single digits. But we have 3 research areas. The magnetic resonance imaging is what I'm going to talk about, and I'll talk about a little bit about some of what my colleagues do as well. The atomic and molecular physics group, they're laser spectroscopists mostly, hence Hertzberg's interest in the first place, but also some theoreticians working in molecular calculations and some atomic calculations also to ridiculously high precision. And our space and atmospheric physics group is concerned partly with atmospheric modeling and partly with slightly further out stuff in the magnetosphere. So they're interested in the Sun-Earth interaction. I'm going to leave them to do their own publicity, and I'm just going to tell you about the magnetic resonance imaging group. I'm going to be even smaller than that. I'm going to tell you about my stuff in the magnetic resonance imaging group. This is one of our magnets. All of the data I'll show you today were acquired on superconducting magnets. So under normal circumstances, this is a 7 Tesla superconducting magnet. That's about 150,000 times the Earth's magnetic field. This magnet has actually quenched quite recently. So normally you keep this superconducting. The superconducting coil sits in here, and then you have a thermal mug of liquid helium that surrounds the superconducting coil, and then you have a thermal mug of liquid nitrogen that surrounds that. All of that boiled off in a hurry one night quite recently. And so this is a very frustrated magnet in a real sense. The group, the MRI center group, there's about 25 people there when they're all there. They're not all there in this summer's photograph, including some visiting scientists. And what we do is magnetic resonance imaging of stuff with short signal lifetimes. So that's in contrast to clinical imaging. If you, ladies and gentlemen, were wheeled into a clinical magnet, depending a little bit on your age, you're very wet, and so you have an MRI signal that lasts a few seconds, something like that. We're interested in everything else. So woods, concretes, plastics, polymers, polymer solutions, gases, all of these things have NMR signal lifetimes that are a few milliseconds, perhaps only hundreds or tens of microseconds. So we have 4 orders of magnitude to fight against. My colleagues who are faculty members, this is Igor Mastikin, and I'll mention a little bit of his research at the very, very end, and Bruce Balcom, who's been there longer than either of us two, who really did the hard work of setting the center up in the first place. I'll mention a little bit about the kind of thing he's up to as we go through. But as I say, mostly I'm going to talk about the stuff that I work on. Of course, all that we do overlaps. There you go, there's a happy Venn diagram of the faculty members at UMB. All that we do overlaps. So we're all about method development in materials MRI, but we have our own particular foci. So materials MRI, we are, and when I say we, that's the royal we, because it happened really before I got there. We are famous in the very small group of people who do materials MRI for inventing the sprite sequence. So when I talk about sprite, that's our particular method for doing materials MRI, and I'll explain a little bit about how that works later on. I'm going to talk about motion-sensitized sprite, because that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in measuring mass transport phenomena with magnetic resonance imaging. And particularly, I promised I'd talk about turbulent flows, so I probably should. So despite the fact that people have been looking at turbulent flows since Da Vinci's time, we still haven't really got a very complete description of turbulence. Turbulence is randomized fluid flow, if you like. When you turn on a tap very slowly, you get a nice steady stream of liquid. If you increase the rate at which the tap is flowing for a little bit, of course, fluctuations creep into that steady stream of liquid. And when you get wildly, randomly mixing fluid, when you get wild fluctuations in the velocity, that's a turbulent flow. And lots of the flows that are of practical interest are, in fact, turbulent. Almost all the ones you use while cooking, for instance. Very important. And beyond that, we have collaborators who are interested in turbulent flows in a variety of different contexts. This is a very made in New Brunswick problem. I have some colleagues in our hydrological engineering group who are interested in how fish make their way up man-made culverts, and we've done some measurements for them to help the salmon, as it were. We also have a number of colleagues who work in computational fluid dynamics, and they're interested in validating their turbulence codes. So they're interested in us being able to make measurements for them that they compare with their data, and I'll talk about some of those a little bit later on. I've got colleagues who are interested in steam turbines and modeling the way in which steam turbines behave, in particular phase transitions. So if you get condensations of turbulent flows or within turbulent flows, that can be really unpleasant to try and code up. So it's nice to have a measurement technique that can maybe contribute. And although we're not making those measurements yet, we're certainly thinking about how to make those measurements with MRI. And I've also got colleagues in Concordia and in Quebec who are interested in cardiovascular flows, and in particular in flows through artificial heart valves. So all of those people care about turbulence. And we care about MRI. And so there's a huge collision of interest. Because although there are lots of ways to measure flow, magnetic resonance imaging is good for a few reasons, and these are they. First of all, as people always tell you, if you're going for a clinical MRI exam, MRI is non-invasive. So you don't have to be chopped up to take pictures of the internal structure of whatever you're looking at. And that's sometimes important for fluid flows. It's not terribly important if you're looking at water, but it is terribly important if you're looking at bubbles in water, which tends to be optically opaque. And I'll talk a little bit later on about cavitation and bubbly flows. The conventional techniques that one might use to measure flow, particle imaging velocimetry, for instance, where you drop some scintillating particles into your flow and film them going by, that's invasive. Not in a very invasive way, but it's a little bit invasive because you had to throw the particles in. Hot wire or hot film anemometry, you need to put a probe into the flow in order to make a measurement, and that's invasive. Laser Doppler anemometry, not terribly invasive, but again, scintillating particles are widely used in LDA measurements. We don't acquire our data in a point-by-point fashion. So if you're used to doing hot wire anemometry, you put a sensor in the flow, in a wind tunnel, for instance, and then you move it somewhere else, and you measure the velocity field there, and you move it somewhere else. You measure the velocity there, and then you build up a velocity field in a point-by-point way. We don't have to do that in MRI. We get signal from the whole sample all at once. We can't then make a velocity field from that one shot. We have to acquire some more signal from the whole sample. But it is potentially, in a signal-to-noise per unit time sense, a time saving over a point-by-point method. Most importantly, perhaps, the not caring about optical opacity angle, and that will be important later on when I come to talk about two-phase flows, particularly, and to a certain extent in applications such as the turbines and things, where building the whole thing out of perspex or glass is not really a practical proposition. Of course, there are some reasons not to use MRI for measuring flow, which you can actually read for yourselves. Although that doesn't seem commendably honest. So magnetic resonance imaging is not a very high-resolution technique compared to, say, well, laser Doppler anemometry for one. We struggle with signal-to-noise, and I'll talk a little bit about why we struggle with signals-to-noise for a while, a little bit later. And really, the signal-to-noise issue becomes a resolution issue. You could get very high resolution if you had enough time, but generally speaking, you don't, because you simply don't get enough signal-to-noise per unit time. And although MRI doesn't care about optical opacity, it's perfectly happy looking inside people, if you wrap a person in tinfoil, it would struggle, because we do have to be able to get radio frequency inside our sample. So metal pipes can be a bit of a problem. And lots of our engineering colleagues would rather make their measurements in metal pipes. We have some ways around that, but for the most part, it's easier to work in non-metallic materials. And here are the conclusions. And that means that for the next bit, you can drop off, and I'll wake you up when we get back to these. So what I'm going to point out is that, first of all, we can make these measurements with MRI. We can measure average propagators. And if you're into fluids, that'll mean something. And if you're not, I'll explain it as we go through. But we can measure something about the mass transport properties of the fluid even without optical access. So even when either the container or the fluid is opaque. Our particular techniques, so our materials techniques, bright MRI, can do this in circumstances that other MRI techniques can't. So almost everything I'll show you today wouldn't work in a clinical MRI scanner. And at the end, I'll conclude that the propagator has got important information for turbulent flow, because it tells you not just about the sort of average velocity, but also something about the velocity fluctuations. Okay, so that'll be the ending, and you can now nap quietly until we get there. I promised to explain how Sprite works, so I will do some of that. First of all, nuclear magnetic resonance, or magnetic resonance imaging. The nuclei in our sample, and mostly in this talk, I'll either be talking about protons, so hydrogen nuclei, or fluorine nuclei, so 19F, have a spin angular momentum. And because they've got a spin angular momentum, they've got a magnetic dipole moment. And that means if you stick them in a large static magnetic field, so something on the order of 7 Teslas, for instance, then they precess, or rather their angular momentum precesses around that field. And the frequency of that precession is proportional to the field strength. It's proportional to two things. First of all, the field strength here, the B0, but also the magnetogyric ratio, the gamma. And the gamma depends on which nucleus you're looking at. So, for instance, the hydrogen nucleus has a slightly higher gamma than fluorine, not much higher, but a little bit higher, and carbon-13 is totally rubbish. So we'll try and avoid that if we can. That means if I have a sample in a big magnet, so here's one end of the sample at this end of the bench, and all the nuclei are precessing around the magnetic field, and here at the other end of the bench, the nuclei are precessing around the magnetic field. If I can change the magnetic field along the length of the sample, so for instance, like this, I'll have the main magnetic field plus some magnetic field gradient, then the precession frequency will depend on position. And for the sake of argument, we'll imagine that the field is big at this end, so everything's precessing quite fast, and we'll imagine that at this end, the field is a bit smaller, so everything's precessing a little bit slower. So now we can tell the difference from different parts of our sample based on that precession frequency. And we can measure that. And that's a very physics-y thing to do, because as time goes by, that difference in precession frequency, of course, turns into a distribution of phase, which depends on the position of all the various bits and pieces in your sample. So as time goes by, that discrepancy in frequency gives us a difference in phase. And that means that our signal tends to die away as the phase along the sample, all the different phases along the sample, cancel. So we've got phase information, we've got amplitude information. So naturally, everybody says, let's do a Fourier transform. And if you do a Fourier transform of that sample with different frequencies of precession, then you get a profile out. You get a one-dimensional image, essentially. And our magnetic field gradient is just applied using a big coil of wire, which is wrapped around our sample, or the patient if you're in a clinical MRI scanner. So if you've ever had a clinical MRI scan, and Stephen was mentioning this earlier on, and you've had to stick your head in the scanner and it goes boop, then that noise is actually the switching of the current through those gradient coil windings to change the magnetic field gradient as you make the measurements. Cool. Everybody happy with that? Anybody actually breathing? Not obviously. Great. Okay, so there are broadly two different ways that we can go about sampling this signal. If you are in the clinical scanning business, what you usually do is keep a magnetic field gradient turned on at a constant amplitude, and as time goes by, you collect the signal, this decaying signal, as the phase dispersion increases down your sample. And at the end of that process, then you just Fourier transform, and you get your profile out. That's called frequency encoding in the parlance of MRI. And there are some problems with that, because there are other things that cause time variation of the MRI signal, in particular all sorts of relaxation phenomena, which are to do with interactions between the nuclei in the sample and the nuclei in the surroundings. So that can mean that there are some things which change during time, and that can cause artifacts in your image. And I'll give you a demonstration of some of those artifacts a little bit later. But that's frequency encoding. That's one way of doing your measurement. The other way of doing your measurement, or another potential way of doing your measurement anyway, is to keep the time constant. So let's fix the time interval over which we're going to make the measurement. And instead, we'll change the gradient value. And gradually increasing the amplitude of that magnetic field gradient, so increasing the difference between the precession rates at the two ends of the sample, gives us the same kind of thing. It gives us the same kind of phase dispersion because of position. This is our particular favorite way of doing things. This is called phase encoding. Now, most clinical scanners actually use both frequency encoding and phase encoding, but we do purely phase encoded imaging. And our particular version of this is the Sprite sequence, as I mentioned earlier on. an important thing to point out is that this time interval here, over which we allow some evolution of the phase, is actually quite short compared to most other MRI techniques. So we're actually making a measurement, we're doing an excitation and then making a measurement within a few tens to hundreds of microseconds, whereas most clinical techniques, which are doing frequency encoding, will be waiting hundreds of milliseconds, maybe even seconds. And that means that we can acquire signal from things for which the signal dies away rapidly, for stuff that has short signal lifetimes, which is most materials other than people and animals, frankly. So up here is an example of sprite MRI images hooked together in a movie of, at the top you can see water being forced through an oil-filled rock, and you can see up the middle this channel developing. This is a rubbish way to extract oil from rocks, because it just the water tends to just shoot up channels and leave quite a lot of the oil behind in large pockets. This is what the enhanced oil recovery folk do. They mix in a polymer with their solution, and you get a nice plug-like displacement of the oil from the rock as you push the stuff through. And mostly in the oil industry, these kind of behaviors are guessed at or possibly practiced on giant oil fields, which is not a good economic plan nor a good environmental plan. So with MRI, you can look at the insides of rock structures without chopping them to pieces, and you can follow the time course of these kinds of evolutions. And this work is actually some of Bruce Bolcom's work, and he does an awful lot of stuff with porous media, using sprite-type MRI to measure the properties of materials and mass transport through those materials. So in our group, we do phase-encoded MRI, and the encoding time is short. So that's compared with most other types of MRI, and that's good for short-lived signals, but it's also good for fast flows, it turns out. If you have a long time interval over which you make your measurement, it's quite possible that any mass transport properties you're interested in have actually gone all the way through, which is disappointing. So for fast flows and for short-lived materials, this short encoding time is important. Perhaps just as important is the fact that the encoding time is always the same. So I'm going to get really close now so that the laser pointer looks more intense. So you can see this is very important. The encoding interval is always the same. I'm changing the gradient amplitude, don't forget. So the encoding interval is always the same. And that means any of the things that evolve with time and affect my MRI signal are actually the same for each average of my signal. They're the same for each acquisition. And so some of those things which lead to artifacts because they change with time in clinical imaging actually don't in sprite imaging, which is important. Cool. I promised I was going to measure mass transport, though, so I should show you why this is a motion-sensitive measurement. We started a little while ago. Here's my pulse of magnetic field gradient. Remember, I'm going to change its amplitude to build up the image. It's really only the area of this gradient pulse that's important, the TP times the G thing. So that means that this area is the same as this area. So as far as producing an image is concerned, the position-dependent phase is the same whether this is just a rectangle or whether it's a rectangle with this up-down bit going on. That's true for stationary nuclei in my sample. However, if the nuclei are moving, so they're going from the low frequency end to the high frequency end during the course of my measurement, then these two gradient waveforms, these two encodings of the phase are no longer equivalent. So a moving spin actually acquires a different phase in this gradient waveform than it does in this gradient waveform. So all I'm going to do is acquire all of my data, instead of with one of these little rectangular pulses of gradient, is with a little up-down lobe attached to it. And in fact, as I increase the amplitude of that up-down lobe, I increase the sensitivity of my measurement to displacement. So I increase the sensitivity of my measurement to the fact that the spins might have moved from one end of the sample to the other whilst I'm doing the measurement. This delta, I'm going to label my motion encoding time. So that it's the time interval between the beginning of this up blip and the beginning of this down blip of gradient. And that's an important sensitizing parameter. The bigger I make delta, the more sensitive I am to motion, and the larger I make the gradient amplitudes again, the more sensitive I am to motion. And I can sensitize my signal like that. Now, the signal will decrease in attenuation because, again, this motion sensitization causes a phase dispersion where we have a range of fluid velocities in my sample. So this attenuation is a reflection of how many different histories of motion the various nuclei in my sample have. But also, there's information in the phase here. It's a complex signal, again. So I can use the old Fourier transform trick on those data. And the information I get out is the propagator. Well, it's very close to being the propagator. There are some subtle differences between this and various other definitions of the propagator. So it's like a displacement spectrum. So these E and D are two different propagators from two different positions in my sample. So for each point in my image, I'm going to get a propagator that I can examine. And as I say, it's a displacement spectrum. So the amplitude of this tells me something about the probability that my nuclei will have moved a certain distance, will have had a certain displacement in my measurement time interval. Most of this oscillation in the wings here is artifact because we've done some rather clumsy sync interpolation to our data. But the position of the peak tells me the most common displacement of my spins. It tells me the modal velocity of the spins in that particular region of the sample, the modal velocity of the nuclei as they move through the sample. And the width of the propagator tells you something about the range of different velocities. So it actually tells you something about how big the velocity fluctuations are at that location. So in a turbulent flow, you can imagine all the spins that are moving through the magnet have some kind of average velocity. They might do something like this, but at the same time, they also have some fluctuation. So I'm measuring their velocity in this direction, that also changes quite wildly as it goes through the sample. So the peak here tells me something about the average velocity, and the width of that peak tells me something about how wild those fluctuations are. And that's quite an important property of the propagator. If I divide this displacement spectrum by the time interval over which I measure it, then I can assign these to random and modal velocities, respectively, as opposed to displacements. And that's how I'm going to build my maps. Now, this fluctuation, this randomness, can be due to turbulence, or it could be caused by just simple molecular self-diffusion, Brownian self-diffusion, in slower flows, or by mechanical dispersion. So if my flow is going through some complicated geometry, like a packed bead bed, for instance, then this width will reflect the degree of mechanical dispersion. Or sometimes those random fluctuations are caused by cavitation, and I'll demonstrate some of those later on. Now, my membership of the MRI Union of MRIing people requires that I show you at least one pulse sequence. That's it. This is the Sprite pulse sequence. And the way these work is this top line here is a history of radio frequency excitation. And these two lines are histories of gradient application. So I turn on the magnetic field gradients where you see an orange block here. You'll recognize these already. These up, down, gray blips are the motion sensitizing bursts, pulses of magnetic field gradient. And the orange blips are just the imaging pulses of magnetic field gradient. And we actually follow quite a long trajectory where we have, this is actually the whole trajectory for the G1, the primary phase encoding gradient, where we have a whole sort of almost spiral trajectory here. Each of these is a little burst of radio frequency excitation. So I turn on my radio frequency amplifier at 300 megahertz for a small amount of time, and then after the time interval TP, that's the constant one, you'll remember, I acquire a little bit of signal. So we do that for 2,000 and some points and build up an image. The fact that I've got two gradients turning on and off here means I've actually got two-dimensional imaging information. So I've got a two-dimensional image. I'm only measuring here the motion along one axis. So most of the velocity maps I'm going to show you after this, I'll just show you the velocity left to right, as opposed to any other component of velocity. But it's equally possible to put these up-down labels on the other axis and so measure the velocity component in this direction and in this direction. So we can do three-dimensional imaging quite easily, and we can do three-dimensional velocity encoding quite easily, and then we have terrible trouble presenting the data. So I'll show you the easy stuff. Okay, and just to reiterate, this time interval delta, that's between the beginning of the two gradient lobes, and that's our motion sensitization interval. Okay, I should point out, I did mention earlier on that MRI has rubbish signal to noise. So I actually have to acquire those data over quite a long time interval, tens of minutes. Sometimes single minutes to acquire a three-dimensional image, that kind of time interval. So all of the measurements are highly time-averaged. When I look at turbulent flow, I'm not trying to do a snapshot in any sense at all. I'm trying to acquire some steady-state statistics of the motion. On the plus side, if you were doing laser Doppler anemometry, you would acquire a whole time series of data and calculate the time averages. But in this case, all the time averaging is done for you. And you can control the way you do the time averaging to a certain extent, but not with the same degree of flexibility that you would have if you had a really, really fast instant technique. Enough on the background. I'll show you some data. Here are some data. This is the flow of sulfur hexafluoride gas, which is a very peculiar molecule. It happens to be a very NMR nice molecule because it's got six fluorines on every molecule, so it's quite a lot of signal for your buck, although it's quite a lot of bucks for SF6 as well, so that's perhaps not the best analogy. It's very dense. It's five times denser than air. So if you fill a balloon with SF6, it's like throwing a soccer ball around. It just goes thunk. which is fun in first year lectures. If you breathe it in, it's the opposite of helium. So instead of making you sound like Mickey Mouse, it makes you sound, well, like nothing on earth. But it's not recommended because it's a suffocant. So don't all go away. But so is helium. So don't go away and breathe helium or SF6, please. Without a trained professional. Stephen, did that mean you were a trained professional? Stephen will administer any first aid required after breathing in helium or SF6. So the colour map here just reflects the modal velocity. So I've taken my propagator measurement and picked the peak and said, there you go, that tells me something about the average velocity in that imaging pixel. And the scale here is something like minus 20 metres per second to plus 50 metres per second. That's quite important. That represents Mach 0.12, which isn't very fast in real terms. But in terms of MRI, this is about an order of magnitude, well, actually nearly two orders of magnitude faster than anything anybody else can measure, because everybody else uses long time intervals. So this kind of flow would be invisible in a clinical scanner. And in fact, I'll give you a swift glimpse of just how invisible. It would be that invisible in a clinical scanner. So the color map here tells you something about the average velocity at each location. So here, above this bluff obstruction, the gas is flowing from left to right. There's a kind of step in the middle of the tube. The tube is actually cylindrical, so this step is a half cylinder. The gas rushes through the narrower gap, of course, and you also downstream get a little recirculation zone. So this is backwards velocity behind, in the wake, if you like, of the bluff obstruction. The Reynolds number here is about 210,000. So for those of you who aren't into fluids, the Reynolds, bless you, the Reynolds number is kind of a balance of inertial versus viscous effects in your fluid. So the higher the Reynolds number, broadly, the more likely it is that your fluid will be turbulent. Or perhaps better put, it's more likely that a very small instability can cause your fluid flow to become turbulent if the Reynolds number is high. So generally speaking, high Reynolds number corresponds to turbulent flow. In a pipe, for instance, turbulent flow is Reynolds himself said it comes on at about 2,000 and a bit Reynolds number. So this is highly turbulent. And just to emphasize, only our sprite measurement, because of that really short time interval, can make these kind of measurements at this kind of flow rate. So, I don't want to diss clinical imaging anymore. So we should move on. But I mentioned earlier on that, but not move on far enough to get rid of this image. Look, they still can't see anything. I mentioned earlier on that the width of that propagator, so far we've only used the peak, right? That was the modal velocity in that velocity map. The width of that propagator, the signal loss, which we control in our sprite measurement, tells us something about velocity fluctuations. So I'm just going to show you some bulk measurements. This is now not an image. It's just a measurement of the width of the average propagator over the whole sample. And the important thing here is that I'm going to change the measurement time. So I'm going to change that TP interval and make it longer and longer and longer as I measure the bulk propagator. And this, the slope of the curve here tells you something about the width of the propagator. So where the curve is steep, that's a very broad propagator, that's wildly fluctuating velocities. And where the curve is shallow, that's a narrower propagator, so the velocities are not fluctuating quite so wildly. And the reason we do these measurements is to show that over a whole different range of timescales, we essentially, and these are quite noisy, but we essentially get data that overlaps one another. So essentially this is a single curve for all those different timescales. And in fact, these two different slopes, here and here, are different regions of high turbulence and low turbulence within the sample. So they're different spatially resolved regions that are all contributing to the bulk signal. Now, because that measurement doesn't change with the observation time, then we can make an approximation that allows us to map things Batchelor suggested. We can associate these wild fluctuations in velocity with something I'm going to call a turbulent eddy diffusivity. Now, you can think about, so I'm going to give these an eddy diffusivity coefficient, a single number that somehow represents the width of those propagators. You can think of it like a molecular self-diffusion coefficient. If a liquid has a high molecular self-diffusion coefficient, then the molecules of the liquid will actually travel quite a long distance over some time interval. A low self-diffusion coefficient, and they won't go very far at all in their Brownian random walks. Well, in a turbulent flow, all of these nuclei have a random component to their flow as well, It's just very much bigger than it would be. The random displacement is very much bigger than it would be just for molecular, just for Brownian self-diffusion. So it's a very similar sort of property to a self-diffusion coefficient, but it measures the kind of wild fluctuations associated with the turbulent flow. And because we're confident that these measurements don't really change with the observation time, that means we can map the eddy diffusivity throughout our sample. These are the MRI data down here. Are measured at different time intervals. Where you see a brighter color, so going to the warm colors, that's a high value of the turbulent diffusivity coefficient. So it indicates wildly fluctuating velocity. And at the low end, that's a low value. So here, in the flow above the obstruction, you can see that the fluctuations in velocity are low. And in the wake downstream of the obstruction, and here in the boundary layer over the obstruction, then the fluctuations in velocity are high. And we associate those with high turbulence here, and here, and lower turbulence in this very directed flow along the top. Now, our computational fluid dynamics colleagues, so the guys who are calculating these and want their code validating, they're not so happy with this parameter as I am. I'm happy with this parameter because I work with molecular self-diffusion coefficients all the time. They would rather map turbulence kinetic energy, and I can't be confident of extracting the velocity fluctuation parameters from these exactly, so I'm going to compare these two, even though they're different units. That's probably not very good practice. But over here, this is the diffusion coefficient. And again, the contours basically reflect how much turbulence there is. Over here, this is turbulence kinetic energy. And once again, the contours reflect how turbulent the flow is. So in the wake, the flow is much more turbulent than it is going over the top. And we're quite pleased with that correspondence. So at the moment, Olushigin, who I mentioned earlier on, is now playing with a bigger pump. We did these measurements with a little tiny pump, and we've got a big one now. There it is. It's really scary. We actually accidentally blew our technician out the window the other day. And so we're at the moment working on going slightly faster with our SF6 flows. The nice thing about working with such a dense gas is that the speed of sound in SF6 is only about 124 meters per second. So we're quite close. We can get to Mach 1 with our pumping equipment. When we calculate on the back of an envelope whether we can still measure it with our MRI sequence, we can. Whether we can actually in practice remains to be seen. But that's the development of that gas flow. I promised earlier on that I would mention two-phase flow as well. So that's a single-phase gaseous flow that other MRI techniques wouldn't be able to look at. And that emphasizes the fact that when I've got a short measurement interval, I can measure fast flows, which is important for these sequences. The other important thing about the short measurement interval was that it was constant, remember? And I said that means that we don't get some of the artifacts that clinical images do. This is an example of one of the artifacts that clinical images might get. This is from the American Journal of Rentgenology, which, as you all know, is the study of radioactive old people. This young man, a 17-year-old man, came into an MRI scanner wearing a hair gel which was filled with iron particles. Get me out! So he causes some perturbations to the magnetic field. Maxwell says that wherever you get a boundary between different materials that have different magnetic susceptibilities, that's this chi parameter here, then you get a magnetic field gradient. And the degree to which those magnetic field gradients affect the signal changes with time. So this is one of those artifacts I mentioned earlier on. If you have a sequence with a constant gradient in which you measure your signal evolving with time, you get an evolving what's called a point spread function, which gives you artifacts in the image like this. And those are some of the most exciting artifacts I've ever seen. Because we've got a constant measurement interval, we don't experience those artifacts. So this is a sprite image of, in fact, one of those fish culverts. So this is fluid flow going from left to right out of a hole into a big thing. There are fish swimming this way. We didn't have any real fish in our magnet because it was quite small. This is about 5 centimeters. They have to be very small fish. But the important thing here is that there's an interface here between the liquid and the air around it. And that interface would cause all sorts of trouble in conventional clinical style imaging, but doesn't worry us because it causes the same attenuation every time we make an interval. So we don't have a point spread function artifact. I mentioned the time averaging earlier on. You can see the splash here. Remember, this is time averaged over several minutes. So this is like many, many snapshots of the splash all overlaid one on top of the other. Now, my colleagues at Cambridge are interested in two-phase flows because they work in the chemical engineering department. So they care about two-phase flows for all sorts of reasons, for cleaning gases, for cleaning the liquids, for carrying out reactions. And two-phase flows have been quite well studied over the years. Horizontal two-phase flows, this is from a paper by Alvis, talking about essentially the phase diagram. Oh, I said there wouldn't be any phase diagrams. Essentially the phase diagram for a two-phase flow. So as you change the relative velocity of the gas and the liquid, the nature of the two-phase flow changes. This is a spray of well-dispersed droplets of liquid in a gas, and this is bubbles in the liquid. So those are the inverse of one another, and you kind of go through these transitions to get from one to the other. We were interested particularly in very small bubbles, very well dispersed in flow. And to get there, you need to be going at quite high velocities, which rather killed any of the other MRI techniques we might have wanted to use. And the reason we're interested is that this is a cooling application. So we have some friends who work in the nuclear industry, enough said, for whom this is a problem. And as you increase the fluid, the liquid velocity, we can manage to disperse the bubbles throughout the tube. So this is the diagram that compares with Alvis's paper that I showed you a minute ago. Big bubbles at the top. As we increase the liquid velocity, those bubbles get smaller and they get fairly evenly dispersed throughout the tube. Not evenly enough that we don't see the effects of buoyancy. We do see some buoyancy effects as we go along our sample. Now, two things to point out about this. First of all, it's absolutely chock full of gas-water interfaces, so it causes all sorts of artifacts in conventional MRI. And second of all, it's optically opaque. So because of the bubbles, because of the dispersed bubble field, we can't use any conventional optical techniques to measure the velocity. So this was the work that Mark Sankey did when he was visiting us from Cambridge. And I mentioned before that we can measure the X and Y and Z components of velocity. So this is actually the velocity in and out of the board. This is the velocity up and down the board. Come back, laser pointer. There you are. And this is the velocity left to right. Oh, she's gone again. Come back. Ah, there we go. And you can see the effects here of the buoyancy. So at this end of the tube, the bubbles have risen towards the top, and that changes the way the velocity field behaves along the length of the tube. So this measurement, which, as I say, we did for our colleagues who were interested in the two-phase flow for a cooling application, this measurement is important because when this flow goes around a bend, the bubble distribution changes. And at the outside corner of the bend, there are fewer bubbles. And there, accelerated corrosion happens. Partly because of the composition of the fluid that's involved, actually. Partly not because of the presence of the bubbles. But the presence of the bubbles is very important in determining where the greatest corrosion will happen in these cooling tubes. And in the particular setup we were looking at, there were about 100 of these cooling tubes all going into a giant manifold. So this measurement only works because we're using a constant time interval, and that means we don't have any of those artifacts associated with the interface, and because the time interval is short, which means we can measure reasonably fast flows, which are necessary just to keep the bubbles dispersed in the flow in the first place. So the measurement method works with two-phase flow, but it's more interesting to look at two-phase flow when the flow itself actually causes the phase separation. So if there's a big pressure drop in a fluid flow, and the pressure drop is sufficient to take the liquid below the saturated vapor pressure, then you get bubbles spontaneously forming. And this is something known as hydrodynamic cavitation. And you've probably seen pictures of propellers on submarines and things that get destroyed by cavitation. What happens is these bubbles develop where there's a pressure drop in the fluid, and they collapse and expand rapidly, and there are high pressures and high temperatures, and they erode whatever surface they're up against. And so this is a very important problem for our colleagues who are interested in steam turbines, so in power generation, because they have both problems. They have problems in liquid-filled turbines where hydrodynamic cavitation develops, and they also have problems with phase changes going the other way in steam turbines where they have condensation. All of these things can damage the turbines and wreck the efficiency of their turbine machinery. So Alex has been working on hydrodynamic cavitation in the magnet. This is his pot of stuff, which he thrashes through a 4.8 Tesla vertical bore magnet using essentially a swimming pool pump. And this constriction in his glass pipe causes a sufficient pressure drop that we can actually get some cavitation. So that is the fluid stationary inside the pipe. So that's a three-dimensional image, gives you some feel for the distribution of the shape of the pipe. If we turn the flow on sufficiently fast, then you can see the cavitation zone begin to develop here. So this is the flow is right to left, so downstream of this abrupt constriction, you get bubbles developing here along the walls of the tube. And you can both hear this and see it in the tube itself. And in fact, acoustic detection is one of the ways that people have measured cavitation up to now, by listening to see what noise the bubbles make. The flow needs to be about 20 meters per second at the middle of this particular setup to cause cavitation. And the representation here of the 3D data set has been thresholded, so you can see the shape. We do have information out here in the dark zone. We have information in the cavitation zone, but I thresholded it out so you can see the shape of the cavitation zones. Now, that's a density image. But of course, we can also extract the velocity information from that, because we're still making this velocity-sensitized sprite measurement. And so we can take the modal velocity. That's the peak from our propagator measurement once again. And we're currently deciding whether or not we can have velocity information in the cavitation zone. The signal-to-noise of these particular measurements is very easy to improve. In the clinic, you can't average forever because patients get bored. But strangely, Alex's pump never gets bored. Alex might get bored, but his pump doesn't. So he can keep thrashing the fluid around for a long while. So we may have to do another pass with these data to decide exactly how much information we can have in the cavitation zone. The flow through here, you can see, is broadly plug-like. On the way in and on the way out, develops a sort of jetting feature after the cavitation zone. And this only works because, first of all, that encoding interval is short, and so we can measure fast flows, which are necessary to cause the cavitation, and secondly, because it's constant. So we don't actually get all sorts of really unpleasant genology-type artifacts there at the cavitation boundaries. We've actually got data acquired a variety of different encoding times, and these data we can back extrapolate to zero, to an artificial time zero, which gives us a real measurement of the volume fraction, a quantitative measurement of the volume fraction in the cavitation cloud, which is a very difficult thing to get and certainly impossible to get optically. And also, the decay may or may not. We're currently deciding whether or not it gives us the information we want. But the decay in these kind of situations is often interpreted as a measure of droplet size, or as a measure of pore size in porous media. So the rate of decay across those various time points also potentially gives us some information. So this is hydrodynamic cavitation. You can also cause bubble formation by using acoustic fields. And my colleague Igor Mastikin, the third person in that picture at the beginning, that's some of his research area. And he did send me the keynote file so I could show you some of his latest and very most beautiful data. But he sent me it in Keynote 08, and I've only got 07, or 09, and I've only got 08, or something like that, so I couldn't actually open it. We just have to believe me. It's beautiful. So to conclude, and this is the conclusion slide, so if you want to wake up now, if you want to poke anybody who's still asleep, great. Okay, so this is what I said I'd say. MRI measures average propagators, so we can measure that information about displacement, something about the mean displacement, and about the displacement fluctuations non-invasively, even if I can't get light into the sample. You need a purely phase-encoded technique like Sprite. It isn't necessarily the case that Sprite is the only one that could do this, but it's the one we use, and it's the only one that's out there at the moment. You need this kind of purely phase-encoded technique if you want to look at anything with phase boundaries in it, or if you want to look at something that's really fast. And when I say really fast, I mean really fast for MRI people. This is not really fast, obviously, for other measurement people. And that propagator has got a whole stack of information in it, not just the mean velocity, but also something about the velocity fluctuations, which helps us map the turbulence field. Rod McGregor is our peerless NMR technician. Murray Olive and Brian Titus work in the machine shop, and there's another Brian. Brian Malcolm is the glassblower, and he built the cavitation setup. And some of this work is funded by NSERC, and some by ACOA through the Atlantic Innovation Foundation, and some by the Harrison McCain Foundation. And thank you for listening.